From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're revisiting some of the most powerful conversations so far this year. As Ukraine marked its 1 year of unprovoked war with Russia, I sat down with an independent journalist based in Sacramento who has traveled to Ukraine to make sure their stories continue to be told. Martin Kuz is driven by a deep connection that goes beyond journalism. His father fled Ukraine following World War II, never able to return. Martin spent the past 12 months traveling to his father's homeland, first arriving in the days leading up to the 2022 invasion, and then returning again last summer during an all-out war that continues today. I spoke with Martin upon just landing back from his third reporting trip, this time in eastern Ukraine. We sat down and talked on the 1 year since the official start of the war. Given that you're an independent journalist, you're based in Sacramento with more than 30 years of experience as a journalist, you also wrote that the series of reporting that you've done in Ukraine for the past year, that no story has felt more personal than the war in Ukraine, which is your father's homeland. I'm curious, with your experience as a journalist, yet with this very personal connection, how that shaped your approach to reporting on this war.
I think in the case of the war in Ukraine, my emphasis has been on the impact of ordinary Ukrainians. It hasn't been so much to look at what's happening with officials or even, for that matter, the military. When I've covered war previously in Afghanistan, it revolved very much around kind of what was happening with the U.S. military, what was happening with the Afghan military. And if I have one regret about my coverage of that war, it's that I didn't delve more deeply into the personal experiences of Afghans. And with this war, in part because of the family connection, and knowing that every Ukrainian feels the effect of the war, I wanted to try to capture some of those experiences and provide readers with a bit of insight into what it's like to have war upend your entire existence.
Given that your first visit to Ukraine last year was in the days prior to the invasion, and then you returned in the summer of last year, and then you joined us on Insight, I mean, it's one thing to use hindsight, knowing what we know now and the unknowns of what we know now, but did you think the Martin Kuz of this time last year would be surprised that we're having this conversation about Ukraine today?
Once Russian troops and tanks poured over the border on February 24th of last year, I was convinced, sadly, that we were in for a long slog. I don't think that's all that surprising, given that the support from the West has been strong, but it hasn't provided Ukraine with a decisive advantage on the battlefield. Effectively, you have a bloody stalemate. And the biggest surprise at the start of the war clearly was the strength of the Ukrainian military and perhaps the incompetence of the Russian military. Both sides, I think there were misconceptions on either side of that military scale. The Russian military was considered to be essentially invulnerable, unstoppable. The Ukrainian military was considered to be sort of ragtag and disorganized. What we have found instead is more or less the opposite. We have found an extremely effective fighting force in the Ukrainian military, and we have found a Russian military that really seems at a loss when it comes to basic military strategy and have suffered catastrophic losses. But I think, unfortunately, in the calculus of Vladimir Putin, like Russian leaders before him, human life doesn't matter in Russia. And they simply are fighting a war that resembles World War I and World War II in that it's a war of attrition. They are simply feeding more bodies into the wood chipper, more Russian soldiers dying every single day. And knowing that that was likely to be Putin's approach, I'm not at all surprised, unfortunately, that we're sitting here a year later talking about the war again.
Given that your focus were personal stories, intimate stories of daily lives of Ukrainians, at one point in your reporting journey last year, did you know that you needed to return for a third time this year in the new year?
Once the invasion started last February, it became clear to me that this would be the most important story I had ever covered, and in some respects, perhaps the last story I'll ever cover. It feels to me, in a sense, that all my reporting in the years prior to 2022 led me to this point to try to bring whatever meager skills I have to bear on telling the story of Ukrainians caught in the vice of war. And it is, without a doubt, a personal sort of mission for me. And that is unlike anything I have really ever covered previously. I hope that I have brought empathy, compassion, heart to my reporting in the past of various subjects. But this connection with my father's homeland cut so deeply for me and has become, it's fair to say, it's all-consuming. It is what I focus on every single day, what I wake up thinking about, what I go to sleep thinking about. And I think it's also a sense that this is the contribution that I can make, that this is my effort to continue to tell these stories so that American audiences, Western audiences, don't forget the struggle and the suffering of everyday Ukrainians that goes on and on and on as long as this war continues.
Given that you went three times in the span of 12 months, you know, in the days before the invasion to last summer, and you just returned for a third time, do you view each reporting trip as its own chapter?
In a sense, yes. The scale of the invasion, and even with all the intelligence that suggested the invasion would begin last February, I think most people were surprised that Putin went all in. He wasn't trying to bite off chunks of Ukraine. He was going for the whole country. Even if he wasn't sending tanks and troops into Western Ukraine, the idea was to topple the Zelensky administration and put in a puppet government. So at the outset, it's that this overwhelming force that swoops into Ukraine, and you're simply trying to gain your bearings and tell the story of Ukrainians caught by surprise, even with the warnings, and how they are trying to acclimate in a circumstance in which there is no precedent. There isn't anything like war so that you can really be fully prepared for it. When I returned in the summer, at that point, the battle lines had more or less cohered. And so central Ukraine, for instance, and northern Ukraine had become more or less safe. And in and around Kyiv, the capital, you had suburbs like Bucha and Irpin that had become notorious because the names of those towns were synonymous with killing fields, with what I would consider to be Putin's war of genocide, where civilians were gunned down simply for trying to leave the area, civilians who had their hands up at the time that they were shot dead. And so I wanted to provide a sense of how those areas were attempting to endure even as the war continued, and it appeared that their lives had stabilized to a degree. Going back now, this month, was an extension of the reporting in the summer, but going to a part of the country that I hadn't visited previously, which is eastern Ukraine, an area that continues to be heavily bombarded by Russian forces from across the border. And it was looking even more closely at this idea of how do people endure day to day when artillery is incoming and outgoing, when power is non-existent, when the only heat comes from a wood stove, when there is little, if any, communication with the outside world. The deprivation in eastern Ukraine is extreme. And as an extension of the reporting I had done previously, I wanted to try to offer a bit of insight into how difficult the lives are for Ukrainians day to day, and also that attention spans in the West can be a little short, and to say, look, you're still hearing artillery. You're still seeing missiles drop into a city like Kharkiv, which was about 1.5 million people before the war began, the second largest city in Ukraine. Now it's a city that's pitch dark at night. And in the deprivation that people are experiencing, do you realize not only the extreme conditions in which they live, but also a testament to their resiliency, their ability to sustain daily life. And that to me is inspiring, even as my prevailing feeling is one of anger and sadness at what they're having to go through.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Sacramento-based journalist Martin Kuss, who spent the past year traveling to Ukraine to understand the toll of the war. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment. This is Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're continuing my conversation with Martin Kuss, a Sacramento-based journalist who has spent the past year traveling to Ukraine to understand the toll of the Russian invasion on everyday Ukrainian lives. I spoke with Martin as he just returned from his third reporting trip, which marked the 1 year since the official start of the war.
When you mention, you know, kind of the last 12 months, and I look at the reporting that you've shared through your reporting in Sacktown Magazine and then also the Christian Science Monitor, but also on Twitter and on Facebook, you chronicle these daily lives and you capture these incredibly personal stories of Ukrainians. How did you meet each person that you profiled and really get them to open up and share intimate devastation and loss?
Great credit goes to translators with whom I've worked, who have helped me better understand where to find the stories to share with readers. I do as much planning as I can before I go over and identify areas that I'm interested in visiting, but I rely very much on my translators to help me connect with Ukrainians who are living their lives, and I'm visiting from abroad, and I show up and I start asking questions. And what I have found by and large is that Ukrainians want their story to be told. No matter how deep their suffering or how great their loss, they seem to have an understanding that to remain silent allows Russia to continue operating with impunity. And I think they don't want people to forget around the world what they're going through. And so when I visit a village like Kamianka, about 80 miles from Kharkiv, near the city of Izum, another town that experienced horrible atrocities when Russians occupied the area early in the war, Kamianka is a village of about 1,000 residents. Every single home is damaged or destroyed. It is considered a 100% loss. And yet there are still about 30 to 40 residents living in the area. And I met one man, Vasily, who was thrice victimized by the Russians, suffered a shrapnel wound from artillery when his house was hit, later was hit in the head with a Kalashnikov by a drunk Russian soldier during the occupation. And then after Ukrainians had liberated Kamianka, Vasily, who was a farmer, was out clearing his fields of the war debris that the Russians had left behind, ammo boxes, there was incinerated tanks, and he was simply trying to prepare his fields once again for planting and harvesting, and he stepped on a landmine and lost his left foot. And Vasily, in many ways, embodies the Ukrainian spirit. Here is a man who has lost so much, and he doesn't wallow in self-pity. What saddens him is the suffering of his fellow Ukrainians. The only time that he broke down during our conversation was when he was recalling the destruction of neighbors' homes, the screams of farm animals ripped open by artillery, the death of one neighbor, a man who was left lying in his yard for weeks by the Russians. He doesn't express any sorrow for himself. He's talking about resuming his farming as best he can while on crutches, waiting for a prosthetic foot. And meeting people like that, their willingness to share these intimate, devastating stories with me, it feels then like a kind of duty to bring those stories to a wider audience. And it's, again, thanks to the translators in Ukraine who also approach their work with a degree of sensitivity that can't be understated, because they too, of course, are suffering. Every translator with whom I've worked has been separated from family. Some of their parents have had to evacuate. Childhood homes have been destroyed. So for them, it isn't simply a job. They're also trying to share this narrative of Ukraine under siege with the wider world.
You also shared another story of a mother and her daughter, Victoria and Olena. You spoke with Olena because Victoria was killed. They lived a mile from each other and would walk to each other's homes on a regular basis. And Victoria didn't show up one day. And they would eventually, what you described, they found her body in a crude grave marked with wooden crosses with the number 76 next to it. What did Olena teach you about that loss, losing her daughter at 52 years old? Her daughter was 52.
Olena spoke with such eloquence about her daughter and about the bond that they shared. And in one great respect, what she taught me was less what she actually said than the fact that she continued talking to me through her tears. She almost never stopped crying as we had our discussion, which probably lasted 45 minutes. So the pain is right there before you, and yet she wants to tell the story of Victoria. And there is so much in that. There is the warmth of a mother, pain of a mother, but it also summarizes the suffering of a nation. And this goes back to that idea that every Ukrainian has felt loss to one degree or another. And what I learned from Olena, who grew up in the Soviet era, who understands Russian oppression going back decades, is the need for Ukraine to stand free and independent of Russian oppression. She has paid a grave price as a Ukrainian, and the Ukrainian people have done nothing more than simply try to live free, and for that they're paying the ultimate price. And Olena, she's not about to submit to Putin, to the Russian regime. In fact, she's ever more defiant. And so beneath all of that pain is this resolve of steel that you can kill us, you can physically remove people from our lives, but you cannot douse the Ukrainian spirit. And it wasn't her pronouncing that in grand terms. It is in that understated way of sharing her loss, but also with that determination that she will go on and that her people will go on. So you see in those discussions the personal dimension of what Ukrainians are enduring. But if you take a step back, you can also see some of those larger themes.
Yeah. What struck me was the people that you spoke with, they're all older. You know, Vasily is 65, Olena is older, and you spoke with Maria, who's 80 years old, and you touch upon this reality that they really have lived this trajectory of what it is to be Ukrainian, even before it was a country, when it was part of the Soviet Union. When learning about Maria, who, when reading from your reporting, she lives in her summer kitchen after a rocket hit and destroyed her home, does she have that same fierce stubbornness, and understandably so, of staying in her home even when it doesn't even exist anymore?
Absolutely. One aspect of her story that I didn't share is that she has a son who is married, and they lived with Maria in Petropavlivka, which at the moment is experiencing a horrific shelling. We spoke as these enormous booms surrounded us. And Maria has, at this point, sadly, adapted to this terrible circumstance. Where she is so defiant, she has a son who actually left for Russia with his wife. They came to her after Maria's house had been destroyed by an artillery shell and simply said to her, "We're leaving. You can come with us or you can stay." And Maria said, "I'm not leaving." And you see in that decision not only the reality of a woman who is 80 years old and for whom making that kind of transition would be difficult. It is because she's Ukrainian. She refuses to set foot in Russia again. She has cut off contact not only with her son, but with other relatives and friends who are in Russia, who continue to deny that the war is something that Russia has perpetrated upon the Ukrainian people. There is a closed media ecosystem in Russia, and that propaganda is virulent and sort of comprehensive. And so a lot of Russian people have no idea that this is Putin's war of aggression. And so when Maria tries to educate, or had tried to educate people in Russia that she knew, she realized they believed the lie. And
not her lived experience, what she's experiencing.
It's all fake news, and from the perspective of Russian people. And it's extraordinary as a journalist to spend time with someone who has lost her home, in effect lost her son and daughter-in-law, and to think there are people, in effect millions of people around the world, who don't believe the truth of what Maria is going through every day. I asked her, you know, you have this artillery going off around you all day long, every day. How do you sleep? And she said, "You get used to it." You know, with no fanfare, with no kind of ostentatiousness, she simply is saying, "I will go on." And I find that to be inspiring. And I find it incredible in that, I know, here in America, it's not to suggest for a moment that everyone's life is easy or simple. But when you consider people getting frustrated about their Starbucks order being mixed up, and then you see this woman who's living in her summer kitchen, which is a room about the size of a walk-in closet. She has a bed, a couple of chairs, and a wood stove. And she's not about to give in to Russia, an 80-year-old grandmother. And that, I think, is sort of exemplifies that strong Ukrainian spirit and that resolve to live free.
You know, Maria captures a reality for a lot of Ukrainians, and that's the fracturing of families, you know, when because of misinformation and disinformation. Did you get a sense collectively of the national mood, the morale, as this war enters its second year with really no signs of it ending anytime soon?
The people that I've met throughout the past year have almost to a person suffered a kind of loss. In some cases, it has been obvious. They have lost a loved one, perhaps someone who is serving in the Ukrainian military or with the Territorial Defense Force, a volunteer a volunteer force. In many cases, however, it's more subtle. It's simply this breach that has been created by this war. Ukrainians and Russians weren't by any means one people, as Putin described them a summer before he launched his invasion. But there was a kinship, without question, and a shared history. Now there is a demarcation, and there is a feeling that Ukraine gained its independence in 1991 after the Soviet Union broke apart. But as one person said to me, we knew even then that we would likely have to face Russia in war, that there would have to be blood before we fully claimed our independence. And so much blood has been shed in the past year, and it hasn't for, I think, a moment and for a person dimmed the resolve of Ukrainians to continue fighting. Is there a weariness? Without question. There is extreme deprivation, but there is not a sense of capitulation. I think that perhaps the greatest miscalculation of this entire war is Putin's belief that Ukrainians would welcome the Russian invaders, that they would, quote, feel liberated, quite the opposite. And that underlies all the suffering, all the destruction, all the loss. Underneath all of that, or perhaps above all of that, is this understanding that Ukraine will not acquiesce. And I don't think that has changed from a year ago. In fact, I would argue that it has actually been fortified by military gains, but also by the fact that a year later, Ukraine is still standing, is standing proud, and now the world knows Ukraine. That was something that frustrated my father for many years, was this sense that people thought of Ukraine as just part of the Soviet Union, not as an independent nation. Now the world knows, for the worst reason possible, but the world knows, and I think moving forward, Ukraine, even in the midst of war, can see a different kind of future for itself. And it, I think, is that glimmer of hope that helps sort of fortify their resolve.
I think it's also important to note that given your a freelance and independent journalist, covering a war on your own is not only comes with dangers, it's also expensive. And this wouldn't have been possible without the support of people donating to make this possible. I was looking at your GoFundMe and you had a goal of like $3,000 to cover some of the travel expenses, not all, but the donations surpassed that amount by fivefold, $15,000. What does that mean to you? What does that say to you?
Difficult to find words to express the gratitude. I think it's fair to say I sit before you utterly humbled. I think it reflects two things. One is compassion and concern for Ukrainians, this desire to try to help in whatever way possible. And then I think people understand that there is a connection between sustaining Western support and continuing to tell the story of Ukraine and everyday Ukrainians. To some extent, it might also be a little bit of faith in me and a feeling that I can share those stories, find those stories and share those stories. I was stunned by the response. I had never expected that kind of generosity. What I have found in those exchanges with people who have generously contributed is a kind of empathy that we sometimes lose sight of. Empathy for people on the other side of the world who we likely will never meet, but that we want to somehow help and reach out. We saw this again recently with the earthquakes in Turkey and Syria. There is one important difference, and that is the war, any war, is a man-made disaster. And I think there is this really strong sense that storytelling is essential to kind of displaying the humanity within Ukraine that helps us realize that this isn't simply about tanks and fighter jets and soldiers on the battlefield. This is about average people like you and me trying to survive the day and trying to imagine a future for children and grandchildren. And I think that desire is something that a lot of people actually share, that they want to continue to read these stories. So I am the most surprised at the number of contributions that came in and the amount. And it has made the reporting possible. And it has further deepened this idea for me that the story is so personal. It has only made me more determined to continue telling the story of Ukraine.
You just landed back in the States, but are you already thinking about returning?
I am. And the hope then is to stay a little bit longer and, again, visit areas that I haven't been to before, probably try to get to the south and just get a sense of what is happening in those areas as they attempt to recover and, again, to try to survive as this war goes on. And while I do think that Ukraine will prevail in the long run, I'm not convinced that it will happen sooner rather than later. So, yes, I think there will be at least one more trip this year, and perhaps two. And again, that's because of the generosity of people to this GoFundMe campaign.
It just seems like your mind and your heart is still in Ukraine, even though you're back here in Sacramento.
That's an accurate description. It's a sense of living between worlds. And I have always found journalism, as I'm sure you have, to be something that provides a sense of purpose. For me, it is how I try to give back. And with Ukraine, because it's where my father lived and where he lost so much, there has always been a sense of a kind of unresolved debt, something that I think I vaguely was aware of but didn't fully understand. The war has brought that into much sharper focus, and that's, again, the worst reason why there should be a kind of clarity to my thinking. But it has made me determined to devote as much time as I can in whatever time I have left to telling the story of Ukraine, both while it is caught within war and then what Ukraine will look like beyond war. I do think Ukraine will emerge victorious. I think they will live free and independently, but not without terrific cost. And what people maybe sometimes forget is that when the war, quote, ends, it doesn't really end. Not only is there the physical rebuilding of a nation and a sort of reassembling of day-to-day life, but there is the long tail of psychological trauma. And part of the reporting in this on this trip was looking at this idea of historical remembrance, this notion that Ukraine has suffered throughout its history for centuries. And that includes what my father went through during World War II. Sadly, it's something that's going to continue for decades ahead. And I feel it's my duty as a Ukrainian American to continue to share that story and to remind people about Ukraine and Ukrainians and why it matters that a free, independent, sovereign nation was invaded by a hostile force.
Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Martin Kuz is a Sacramento-based journalist who spent the past year traveling to Ukraine to understand the toll of the Russian invasion on everyday Ukrainian lives. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi. Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to a special edition of Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We've been listening back to some of the most interesting conversations this year. We close with a discovery that is millennia in the making. More than 30 years ago, construction workers unearthed something unusual while building new homes in Placer County's Granite Bay neighborhood. They discovered a fossilized plant buried for eons. The ancient plant was collected by researchers at Sierra College and preserved in its Natural History Museum in Rockland. And there it sat for decades, and only recently has its scientific significance been realized. A curious professor from the University of Kansas took a closer look at the fossil and, after careful examination, released a study suggesting this discovery has helped close a critical gap in the fossil record. It reveals the ancestors of an incredibly diverse family of flowering plants that we all enjoy today, including close relatives of coffee and potatoes, which evolved during the last days of the dinosaurs. I sat down with Richard Hilton, professor of earth sciences at Sierra College, and Brian Atkinson, assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Kansas, about really a fascinating story of this fossil, tens of millions of years in the making. So I want to get a little 101 on each of you. Why did each of you pursue careers in paleobotany and earth sciences? Professor Hilton, I'll start with you.
Well, I started out to be a biologist, but ended up changing in my junior year to geology. And then it's led me ultimately to paleontology, the study of life on Earth in the past. Mm.
And how about you, Professor Atkinson?
Great question. So I started out in undergraduate college as a plant biology major. And paleobotany was not on my radar until much later in my college career. And I saw a talk given by a paleobotanist about his name is Gar Rothwell. Is Gar Rothwell, he's still around. And he gave a talk about how fossil plants can inform understanding of how plants evolved in time. And it made so much sense to me. I asked if I can do a research project with them, and it was a wrap after that. So,
And the rest is, pun intended, history, right? Taking a look back and now leading to this moment now. So, Professor Hilton, you're part of a discovery that was really like tens of millions of years in the making. So let's take that baby step back in time to the 1990s. What were the sequence of events that led to this fossil discovery and how you ultimately became involved?
Well, I was teaching at Sierra College at the time and with the Sierra College Natural History Museum. And I got a phone call from a local fireman by the name of Pat Antuzzi. And he said he'd found what he thought was a dinosaur bone. And I'm going, yeah, right. No dinosaurs around here. Anyway, I went to see him, and he pulled out this fossil. And it was a bone, and it was from the Chico Formation, which puts it in the Mesozoic, the time of dinosaurs. And he said, I think it's a dinosaur. And I said to him, I think you're right, but I can't prove it. So I contacted Berkeley, a guy named Greg Erickson. He did some science on it, and he agreed that it was a dinosaur. And not only a dinosaur, but a young dinosaur. So we started looking, and they were doing houses at the time and digging deep ditches for the piping and so forth, the storm drains. And coming out of these ditches was all kinds of fossils from the ocean. It was an ocean setting. But we were also getting fossils from the land, both plants and animals.
I mean, you're talking that this was, at that time, an ocean setting. So kind of take us back to that time when this fossil was alive. What would we see if we took a walk around this landscape, which is now a largely suburb area in the foothills, like 70, 80 million years ago?
70, 80 million years ago, the original Sierra Nevada was much bigger than the one we have today and extended far to the east and was capped by volcanoes. What was happening in the Mesozoic time of the dinosaurs is Pangaea was breaking up, the supercontinent. And this is about plate tectonics, the fact that the crust of the Earth moves around in plates. And the Americas were moving away from Europe and Africa and opening Atlantic Ocean. And that was closing the Pacific Ocean. By 82 million years ago, that original mountain range had eroded away. You know, miles of rock had eroded away and was deposited offshore in the valley here. And the ocean probably went as far east as maybe Colfax.
Wow.
At the time.
And that's like a, you know, on a good day, like a little over two hour drive from what is the ocean now, like in the Bay Area. That's incredible.
Easily 2 hours. So there was no coast range. There was just, you know, a continental shelf where most of these fossils are being deposited.
Wow. Well, okay. So now, Professor Atkinson, that brings me to you because you're based in Kansas. When did you come into the picture to really understand the significance of this fossil, decades later?
Great question, Vicky. So this all kind of goes back. Much of my PhD work when I was a student in grad school involved this, collecting and describing Cretaceous plants. And by Cretaceous, I mean anywhere between 145 to 66 million years ago. So this is like the last hurrah of the dinosaurs. I wanted to learn more by looking at different, basically, localities or fossil deposits along the West Coast. And this region is actually surprisingly under-sampled or under-collected for this interval of time, for plants, that is. Somebody had told me to get in touch with a professor at Chico State, Russell Shapiro, who told me then to get in contact with Richard Hilton, who had collected all these fossil plants from Granite Bay. And so I did. And, you know, I was expecting to see some cool stuff. And then when they pulled some drawers out, I was blown away. It was some like the best Cretaceous plant material that I've ever seen. It's like the fruits and seeds that were in there are three-dimensionally preserved, sometimes down to the cellular level. And it's like they were just dropped like yesterday. So it's like exceptional preservation. And I will forever remain grateful for Richard and Patrick for collecting that material.
We had a ball doing that.
I bet you did. Yeah.
I can imagine. So, Professor Atkinson, you were very impressed by what you discovered at Sierra College, and your wheelhouse is paleobotany. I'm just curious, why is this fossil so significant, and how does it help fill in the gaps in the fossil record?
Yeah, that's a great question, Vicky. So what this particular fossil is called Paleophytocrene chicoensis, chicoensis being named after the Chico Formation from where it came from. And the genus Paleophytocrene belongs to this family called Icacinaceae, which today is typically only found in the tropics. Icacinaceae is part of this really diverse group of plants called the lamiates. And by diverse, I mean lots of species. We're talking about 40,000 species of flowering plants that include some of the crops that our livelihoods and economy depend on, like coffee, potatoes, tomatoes, those sorts of things. And that diverse group of lamiates really doesn't have a fossil record in the Cretaceous period prior to my work, at least solid evidence. And I just felt like they had to be around. And it's been taking me about 7 years to find this. And so now we have kind of like this missing piece of the puzzle. There's still a lot more work to do, but this was a major, really critical step forward. And it was quite validating too. I was like, there.
Yeah, I can imagine. And 7 years is a long time for an individual, but in the context of this conversation, it's just like a, not even a blink of an eye.
Yeah,
it's just crazy to think about how, I mean, we know what happened to the dinosaurs, that there are periods that can just wipe out species, but yet, you know, this plant species that was essentially fossilized, you know, we can still see it in some respect millennia, eons later.
Yeah, plants are pretty tough. Like, they fare pretty well when it comes to mass extinction events. And that's partly due to, like, how they live. Like, seeds are long-lasting and so forth. So, like, if you just wait a little while, they'll come back.
And that goes back to the Chico Formation that you were talking about, Professor Hilton. Yeah. How large of an area are we talking about?
Chico Formation is kind of intermittent along the east side of the valley from, about Stockton or a little farther south, all the way up to Red Bluff and Redding. And it's full of fossils. I mean, we find lots of invertebrates, bivalves, clams and oysters, gastropods, snails. We find sea urchins, starfish, crinoids. These are related to sea urchins that live on a stem. They're animals. But lots of vertebrates as well. There's been several types of shark and other fish. We have a mosasaur called Cladastes, which we found right here in Granite Bay. This is a seagoing verandid lizard, so related to the Komodo dragon. Three types of marine turtles, and the one dinosaur. In other areas of the Chico Formation, there have been pterosaur remains found and birds. And one mammal. The mammals were evolving in the Mesozoic along with these plants.
You know, how has this fossil, this recent one, helped shape what you teach in the classroom, Professor Hilton? It's pretty cool. You know, it got a lot of interest from the surrounding community.
Well, I mainly do field classes now. But field classes in the past, we used to go to Montana and Wyoming and Arizona. We would have dinosaur digs. So it's really neat in a community college to get students out in the field. And it changes their lives and their outlook of the history, the deep history of our planet.
Yeah. And it could be right under our feet. We don't even have to travel that far, right? What goes into preserving a fossil? I mean, you took part in this in the 90s for the fossil we're talking about today.
Well, it depends on the fossils. You know, some you just collect and keep them dry and, you know, glue things back together. But other fossils, you know, when we go out and collect, we've collected two Triceratops skulls and, you know, they don't come out of the rock just whole. I mean, I had a Triceratops skull on my kitchen counter for 2 years.
That's the first time I've ever heard that.
Assembling all the pieces together to finally get it good enough for display purposes. You know, I've been working on some fossils down here at Ione, and we just did a jaw, for example, of a four-tusked elephant, a gomphothere. And you have to pedestal all around the fossil, dig down, and then it's burlap and plaster on the top, and then you dig under it, and then eventually you dig under it far enough that you can break it off, and you bring the whole fossil with the rock. And then once you get it in the lab, it's the slow, steady, you know, exhuming of this fossil and, you know, impregnating it with chemicals that will preserve it sometimes. But that's a lot of work. So some of them you just bring to the museum, they're already ready to go. Some of them you spend years and everything in between.
A lot of work, but
of
I
work,
also
but
think
fun work.
I was just going to say, it still seems like a lot of fun for you.
Yeah, we have these giant jigsaw three-dimensional puzzles, you know, that we put together. It's a whole lot of fun.
I think that may be the first and only time I'll have someone tell me that they had a Triceratops skull on their in their home on their table. I mean, dinosaur bones, skeletons, as we're talking about, I mean, they're always a big hit when you go to natural history museums. But why do you believe plant fossils are fascinating and how do they help us better understand prehistoric life on Earth?
Yeah, well, you're looking at a paleo environment here. You're looking at the diversity of all the life. And what's nice about the Granite Bay fossils is we had fossils from the land. So looking at all the plants and looking at some of the animals, you get an idea of the diversity that's going on. You can start to form a picture I kind of think of it as looking through a keyhole to the past. You've only got the keyhole, and you just hope that that keyhole gets a little larger and you discover more fossils to make it even more diverse and interesting. But you're looking at the past. It's incredible.
Professors Hilton and Atkinson, thank you for the time and the conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us on.
That's my conversation with Richard Hilton, professor of earth sciences at Sierra College, and Brian Atkinson, assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Kansas, who shared the fascinating story of a Granite Bay fossil and how it helped close a significant gap in the fossil record. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and Victor Carell Martinez, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineers are Antonio Munez and Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.